This is a Pinball News production.
Mike is a Bally collector. So Mike at one point in time had every Bally made from, you know, every Bally pinball made post-war from 1956 to whatever, 1988, I would say. I think he was missing one, maybe an electromechanical Evel Knievel, at one point. And because he's no longer a young fellow, if you've ever met him, he's kind of getting old, like many of us, he's started to pare down and sell stuff off to youngsters like me, who's not really all that young, but regardless. We go to Mike's house. He lives in Ohio. And when you walk in, I went with my buddy, and my buddy's like, that's got to be $20,000 worth of pinball machines that he's using as a crappy desk. Like, that's a Wizard of Oz. This is some Dr. Dude prototype thing. And, you know, all this stuff, he gets all the, you know, because he was one of the largest operators in North America during, like, the late 70s, early 80s. He bought a lot of games from various sources, and he acquired a lot of stuff and a lot of prototypes in that. So when I walked in, I'm with my buddy who's never met Mike before, and I walk in and I go, Mike, what a fucking shithole you got here. And my buddy like kicks me like, we haven't even bought one game. Why are you saying this? You're just going to piss him off. And I'm like, yeah, just relax. Mike's better when you do it this way. You know, trust me. So, next. So, as you can see, we had to kind of go through his stuff to find things. Hit it again. This is his parts, one of his parts, Mechas. And you could, you know, there's a pinball, if you look at this picture, there's a pinball somewhere. But it's like a garbage trowel. He just, when he gets something new, he just throws it on the pile. You know, hit it again. So then he's got a warehouse, too, that's not on his location. That, you see this barrel, this 55-gallon white barrel? That's about three-quarters full of water. And he has those scattered throughout the warehouse because the roof leaks. And instead of fixing the roof, he just puts another barrel under it. And unfortunately, when you walk in there, the humidity and the stank from the water, it's just, it's in all the machines. So we're kind of like, oh, we got to get this stuff out of here. And frankly, he wants to get rid of this stuff. He knows that this is a bad way to store games. But I don't want to say he's not motivated to sell. Maybe there aren't people that want to buy games in this kind of condition. Hit it again. So what we did is we go through and we try and find things. And Mike is, contrary to popular belief, Mike is actually pretty reasonable on his prices. But you can't push them too hard or too far. When Mike says a price, you pretty much just cut the check and, you know, and give him the money. You don't argue with him. And if you do it like that, his prices tend to be reasonable. So maybe the first game he starts out a little high and you give him a slightly dirty look. But after you buy a few, the prices start to come down. Hit it again. And so we're, you know, I'm kind of in a unique situation because all these games all have backglass problems. Like every one. Because of this poor storage. I mean, you can save cabinets, you can save play fields, you can save mechanisms. But backglasses, once they go, they're gone. So I'm like really good friends with the guy, bgrestro.com. Do you guys know that about that guy? Anyways, he's doing like restorations of backglasses that are low production games that nobody is ever going to re-silk screen, and he does them digitally, of course. And they actually look really good. So I have an in. I can get my glasses really cheap or sometimes even free from Steve at BG Resto. So if Mike wants $400 for a game that doesn't have a backglass, most people would be like, well, hell, that sucks because now I got to spend $200 to $400 in addition to get a backglass. Well, I don't have that situation. I basically can get my glass near free or cheap. And so giving Mike the money pries things loose from him in a situation where a lot of people don't have that. Hit it. So you can see that he's just got stuff stored poorly. Hit it again. And he's got baseballs. He's got all kinds of stuff. So we bought about 20 games from him over this summer by just going back constantly and buying stuff from him. And every time I go there, I always try and piss Mike off. Like I told you about the one with his house being a crap hole. So the next time we went, we got there a little early, and we pulled into his driveway, and Mike came out to the door, and he had these pajamas on, and he's got this kind of belly, and no shirt. And I'm like, oh, the Great White North, oh, I'm blinded, I can't unsee this. And I started, you know, going through this whole diatribe about how ugly he was without a shirt, which is, in fact, very true. It's so much that his next-door neighbor almost called the police, thinking that there was some problem. But the thing is that when you do that to Mike, he's easier to work with, because one time we went, and the guy I was driving with is like, "Don't, I don't want you to do any of that stuff. I want you to be completely nice to him." And you know what? When we went there, he was a dick the whole day because I didn't lubricate him socially, you know, on the inside. No, well, maybe that was a bad way to put that. Whatever. Anyway, so next one. All right, so here's some of the games we got from Mike and that, you know, we restored. Like this Happy Tour. This is a Bally Happy Tour. This one had no back glass. The Joust actually was Jim Patla's personal game. It had no back glass. The Big Valley had no back glass. The Gator had the crappiest back glass in the world. So we got all those were BG Restos. And we restored all those. And, you know, we love these Bally. You know, you can go to a lot of shows and see Gottliebs. Everybody loves Gottliebs. And they are undeniably some of the best games. But the Bally stuff you just don't see, and it's great, and it's not a frickin' Williams. Sorry, Duncan. I don't like Williams EMs. They're god-awful. Right up there with Chicago Coin. Well, maybe a little better, but not much. Hit it. So here's some more we got from Pacac. The Little Joe, that's another great game. Loop-de-Loop, unfortunately, had a painted cabinet. Moonshot, the first Bally EM in 1963. So Bally only did three pinball machines in the 50s. They were doing bingos. So they did Balls of Poppin'. They did Circus, which was basically Balls of Poppin' with different artwork. And then they did Carnival with the Pussy Snapper. Do you guys know about the Pussy Snapper? Okay, well, that's another story. I'll tell you about that. And though there's actually a Pussy Snapper on the playfield that... I'm serious. That's what it's... Tim Arnold calls it that, too. Everybody calls it that. It actually, it's hard to describe. Anyway, so after they did those three games, they didn't do any more games in the 50s, and then they came out with Moonshot in 62 or 63, which was a duplication of Gottlieb Tropic Isle. It was like the same playfield layout. And then Magic Circle, you know, all these, hit it, were ones that we got from Mike. Here's some more Mike games. Mini Zag had a wasted back glass. Op Pop had a wasted back glass. Star Jet had a wasted back glass. C-Ray had no back glass. So when you go to Mike's, the other thing is finding the heads. You find the bodies and you can't find the heads. So you guys spend 2 hours looking for the heads because, of course, he doesn't store any of this stuff together. But anyways, these are all stuff that we got from Mike, and we feel really fortunate to have a really good, solid 60s Bally collection from visiting Mike. And we'd like to thank Mike for this. Go ahead, hit it. He was particularly possessive of the Vampire. It's not a really great game, but it is really cool looking. The Trail Drive has backglass animation like Buckaroo, where you got a little cowboy and he shoots a cat, so the cowboy recoils back, you know, as he shoots the gun and the knocker goes off, just like Buckaroo and Cowpoke. And then it's got a cat, like a little mountain lion that spins around, just like Buckaroo, more or less. And that came out in 71, so obviously it was inspired by Buckaroo, not the other way around. Wild Wheels, that's a really rare game. They only made like 500 of them. Oh, and then this one, this is a Zakaria game called Fast Track. There's a video monitor right in the back glass, green screen. And that was alleged that's the only one in existence. Who knows? I've never seen another one. And we got all these from Mike. So go ahead and hit it. So occasionally we get calls from civilians out there that want to get rid of games and want to donate stuff to the museum. And we got a call from a guy in Lansing, Tim Arnold's old hometown, with games he wanted to donate. And here's a picture of, you know, the stuff before we started picking. Hit it. So from him, he gave us a winner. It was a total mess. A Strange World Gottlieb, which I've been looking for 20 years and never really found one for a price I could afford. Surfers, and actually the Bally Kickoff, he made us pay a little bit for. But the Kickoff had no back glass. The Strange World glass was good. The Winter glass was good. The Surfers had a bad back glass. And again, BG Restro helped us. So we got those all restored. And then I sent him pictures, and he's like, wow, I gave them to the right guys. Because the one theme that you will see here is that when people give us stuff, we do something with it. We just don't hang it on the wall or put it, squirrel it away. Because that was the big thing with Mike. A lot of the games that Mike bought, he bought them at auctions. He got them from old amusement parks, whatever. You know, he's like, I've had this game 30 years, and it's been sitting here in the same spot, same condition, basically rotting in his back warehouse for 30 years. You know, when we get it in the matter of 3 weeks, we got it restored, and people are playing it. You know, so that's like the theme. That's why people give us stuff, is because we turn the games into something. We just don't, you know, screw them away. And we don't really sell games either. I mean, it's pretty rare. It does happen, but it's only if I have a duplicate or I'm in a corner and my wife has a gun to my head. But that's the only reason I would ever sell a game. Go ahead and hit it. Now we're going to talk about the Duncan Brown Collective. This is Duncan Brown. He's running our projector. And that's him on his new motorcycle, which, by the way, was a really bad purchase for him and for us, as I will explain in a minute, as I embarrass him. Hit next, please. Okay, so this is a game that Duncan donated. Duncan, microphone's right there. Why don't you tell us about it?
I did a seminar on it years ago.
It's not years ago now. It's the present.
Okay. Back in, like, 1980, maybe. I had designed my own pinball machine and wanted to build it. So I bought a Time Warp that was on closeout from Williams because the game sucked so bad. I think it was $700, brand new in crate, and stripped it down to use for the test bed and the parts, and got some blank playfields from Bally and built this game. It's got 25 drop targets set up, kind of like Breakout. It's got a baseball game pitching flap that the ball comes back out from underneath the playfield, which no one had really been doing under the playfield stuff at that point. It's got two vary targets, which in retrospect sucked.
Yeah, because God knows one wasn't enough.
Yeah. And then the name was just supposed to be every overused pinball theme ever. And it's funny, you got the Little Joe, because that's where Dice came from. That was the Dice game I'd played.
Yeah, Little Joe.
Yeah.
The Bally Little Joe.
Yeah.
Little Joe is a name of that Bally game that was back a couple slides. Little Joe is a theme in when you shoot craps. I think it's double twos, I think, is if you throw double twos, it's called the Little Joe.
Yeah. So there'd been Dice games, but that was the specific one I was thinking of, so it's cool that you got one now.
Yeah.
So I built it up, and you know, it was okay. And then, you know, through the years, I hung onto the playfield. Everything else got lost. And then, however long it was ago, 10 or 15 years, I bought another trash Time Warp and rebuilt the game back into it again. And brought it to Expo, did a little seminar about it. And then, you know, I don't really have room to set it up at my house, so Clay offered to give it a home. It's not donated. It's on loan.
Yeah, whatever. yeah, try and get it back dead cold hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyways, you notice the playfield's black because he didn't want to do a white wood. So he made a black wood. That's kind of a joke. The plastics are insanely boring. And we've got an art guy that wants to actually redo the back glass and redo the plastics. I don't know. He was even talking about the playfield, but we'll come to that in a second. But anyway, so we got this here. One thing is, when Duncan originally did the software in 1980, he did it based on a Williams System 6. It is now running Williams System 7, and he does have the source code for it. So I had him add a few flashers to the back glass, which, you know, made it a little more interesting. Just because, you know, we had extra drivers on the driver board, and Duncan was happy to do it. You know, we did that maybe, I don't know, 6 months ago. So hit next. So the next one, last year he bought this one here, Williams Typhoon. This was one of the lost Harry Williams designs. And Duncan did a whole seminar about it last year. But he didn't have room. And when you saw it here, it looked markedly different. For one, there was no artwork on the playfield, and two, there was no back glass. It was just a pure white wood, as it may be. Well, we've got a guy, Roger Ream, who's sitting right there in front. He's our art guy, and he likes doing touch-ups. He always like doing touch-ups on our play fields. I mean, he really seems to enjoy it. He's like, wow, it's a whitewood. I can make this into something. I'm like, well, here's a pencil. Go to town. You know, so he drew all this stuff on the play field and took this. This is a, in the center here is a rotating motorized wheel that throws the ball around, and he did that kind of, you know, typhoon type graphic on there and put the dragons in the, you know, it's really cool. And then the guy at BG Resto threw together a back glass. So now it looks more like a game, because I know when Duncan had it out here at Expo a year ago, a lot of people just thought it was a broken piece of shit in the corner because there's no graphics, there's no back glass. It just isn't inviting. It doesn't bring you in. But here's something that looks entirely different that nobody else has seen, because this is the only one in the whole world. We felt that doing the graphics helped, and it was a little bit to get Duncan over that hump to believe us, but now he's a believer. Next slide. And he's doing Firefly. So Roger did the back glass and the artwork for Firefly. This has, why don't you tell us how many magnets, and it's got all kinds of neat features.
This is, I talked about it in my seminar last year, these little magnet thingies that I finally figured out what they did and how they work. So I decided to do one. This has five of them. Those are those five big holes in it. And I'm working with Andrew Barney, I don't think he's here today, to wind magnet coils that are actually going to not burn my garage down. We're not there yet. They're still cutting out after a while. And so these magnets, you know, are on the whole game and fling the ball around, and it's a pretty interesting concept that Harry did. I ran into a lot of trouble sourcing wood this year for the playfields, but I finally got 20 or 30 sheets, so I'm good for a while. And then I ran into trouble finding someone with a sander big enough after I'd cut it all, but Pat Lawler helped me there. So I didn't get this one done in time for Expo this year like I hope, but I should have two done next year.
And this will be at the Ann Arbor Pinball Show right in the spring. As a matter of fact, it might be here in time for Christmas?
I don't know. We'll see.
It was supposed to be done for now.
Right.
We were supposed to be talking about it right now and playing it.
Right.
You know, some people met deadlines, other people did not.
Yeah, this is a very complicated game.
Yeah.
Plus the
more like a really complicated individual making the complicated game.
Plus the fun fest he gave me to build it into looked like someone decided pace.
Wait. How
treated
much
his games too well, and yeah. So they.
How much did that fun fest cost you?
Zero.
So we've been donating the carcasses. Yeah. To Duncan to make these games,
yeah.
You know, so that, and admittedly, the last one I gave him wasn't in great condition,
yeah.
You know, and you can hear him bitch and whine about it now.
So anyway, the art is really cool. So this time, instead of making poor Roger draw on a playfield full of parts, I sent him the blank playfield, and he did all the art first, and now I'm putting the parts on it.
And we clear-coated it with a two-part urethane, not too thick, just enough so it doesn't disappear.
And I think he was all excited when he heard the theme was Firefly, and then I pointed out that Joss Whedon was like six when this game was designed. It was not Firefly, the TV series, so he did sexy Firefly bugs instead, which are pretty cool.
Yeah. So, and that's Steve from BG Restro holding the back glass for the game. So, you know, we came through with our end of the bargain, and we're just waiting for Duncan to finish his shit. Hit it. Okay, so some other stuff that we've been doing is at the last show, this guy, a local guy who had been buying games for years and acquiring stuff from overseas, he'd been buying containers and bringing them in, had been storing them very poorly, and he decided that he wanted to get off a lot of stuff. And when you bring stuff in from overseas, you tend to get different games than just the normal Bally Williams stuff and Gottlieb. You get some other things. And in this case, he got a lot of, you know, somewhat rare Italian games. So our friend Stinky, we call him Stinky because all his games stink. And I mean, they stink. They literally smell like body odor. And Coil, which is the guy that does all the work, I don't know why we call him that, brought in a bunch of stuff. So this is a classic case of, you know, what's your garbage is my treasure. And hit it. And so, you know, here's his truck at the show, and he's starting to unload stuff that's of dubious condition. And, like, for instance, here's a demo man that was stored pretty poorly. You can see the water damage on it. And what he does is he stores them in containers, and he had managed to put the containers so close together that in the winter, the snow would just encapsulate the tops of them right across, and it blocked all the vents. So literally when I went in there one February, opened it up, it was raining inside the container. I mean, literally raining. I mean, water coming off the roof. I mean, it's snow outside, and it's raining in the container. And that's what you end up with, hit it again. You get games like this. This is in a lovely Indiana Jones that you can see. It's seen better days. So, you know, he's kind of come to the conclusion that he might have stored these games too long, and maybe he should have sold them 10, 20 years ago, back when I told him to do that. But so he brought a lot of this stuff to the show. And you can see that there's only going to be certain people that are going to buy things like this. Yeah, so hit it. We bought from him some games, and we were actually able to make them into real games. For instance, the Escape from Lost World, that was $150. The Atlantis, that was $300. The Radical was more, that was $500, and so was the Truck Stop. It was directly proportional to how much corrosion and how bad the cabinets were is the prices that you paid. So this was all stuff that he had at, you know, that he was selling that pretty much nobody wanted to buy, or very few people. So he tried to sell everything, and he had a whole row of playfields too that he started out at wanting $100 each, and at the end he was just giving them away. And then the same thing, he had a whole bunch of games that he was starting out at like $500 each, and at the end he's like, it's Sunday, it's noon, I got to have the truck back by 1 o'clock. I still got a half dozen games. You want them? And I'm like, well, I don't want to buy them. He goes, no, they're yours. I just don't want to ever see them again. You know, so he left them all behind, and then we turned them into shit. Hit it. So, like, for instance, the Zakaria Space Shuttle. I didn't even know that game existed. I mean, I guess I hadn't thought about it. That was one that he had in his truck that nobody really wanted. We were able to get that up and running. The Bally Bullseye is a conversion game from a Bally Dash 35, a new playfield and a new back glass and new software from a company called Grand Products. That playfield was brand new. It never had a ball rolling on it. And the reason why I knew that is because the wiring harness was never finished. You have to do some conversions on the wiring harness to make it work. It was never done. Every lamp socket, every screw in the thing was rusted solid to the bottom of the playfield. As we're taking them out, the bottom layer of plywood on the playfield is like coming with the screws because they've welded themselves in rust to the bottom of the playfield. So this is what we had to deal with, but we got through all that and made that game working. And as you can see, we put it in a new cabinet, obviously. It looks great, and it's actually a really interesting game, though some people would argue with that. This other one I never even heard of before. It's a Bell Games, which is an Italian, kind of another Zakaria, you know, wannabe company called World Defender. And he had the playfield, but he didn't have anything else. And I looked it up on the Internet Pinball Database. Thank you very much, Jay. And it turns out that it's a conversion game. It's a Dash 35 conversion. So Jay had the software on it. We downloaded the software. Managed to figure out, there was some limited documentation on it, managed to get the playfield, you know, we stripped it, bottom side had, again, no lamp sockets and no wiring harness. So we made a wiring harness, put in all the lamp sockets, put in all the mechanisms, got the game running with the stock software, and then I needed a backlash. And you can see the backlash has Arnold Schwarzenegger on it. Do you think that's a license theme? I'm just guessing that it probably isn't. You know, but it was a cool backglass. I posted on one of the forums, and a guy from Europe said, I got that glass. It's, you know, hanging on my wall. Do you want it? And I'm like, yeah. Of course, he made me pay for it. He actually made me pay a lot for it. But, excuse me, the rest of the game was free, so it seemed like a subtle thing to do. So one thing this game has up in this corner, there's a kickout hole, and there's a single drop target there. We modified the code so the game actually does multi-ball now. So not only is World Defender a rare game, now it is really a one-of-a-kind because it's two-ball multi-ball. So that's, I think that's pretty cool. And it is actually a neat game. Custom sounds, uses a cheap squeak soundboard with its own ROM, and again, that was on Jay's Internet Pinball Database. Really cool game that you're never going to see anywhere, and we managed to save it from just a playfield leaning up against a wall for sale, and the guy couldn't sell it because nobody wanted it. So, Next one. That's it. Okay, so I just, people always ask, you know, why do we get stuff? Why do people donate shit to us? This is why, because we turn it into something. We just don't, you know, strip all the parts off and hang it on the wall. Though that does happen sometimes, obviously. But like that guy, the stinky guy, he had a whole row of playfields he couldn't sell, mostly Zakaria ones, with no cabinets, no boards, no back glasses. Those ones actually did get parted out because we've got probably the largest Italian pinball collection in North America. We have almost 25 Italian games, you know, from Zakaria, which is, it has to be the biggest one. I mean, if not, it's in the top three. So, you know, we've got all this weird stuff. So people, you know, it attracts, weird shit attracts more weird shit is really what it comes down to. So the stuff comes in and people offer it to us because they know we're going to do something with it. And I think that's the whole purpose here of having a museum is that, you know, you want to rescue stuff that other people would just view as garbage. So you guys got any questions? Anything you want to ask? How long did it take us to restore? Well, it depends. Like that Zakaria space shuttle took 3 months. It just was a mess. I made my own Zakaria test fixture. That took a bunch of time. I had a variety of boards for it, none of which worked, you know, and we were able to get this one working, but not that one. So then I had that David Gersick guy give me a hand on a soundboard. He fixed one of the soundboards that I couldn't figure out. You know, so we do call in people that, you know, it's not like just all me, that is what I'm trying to say. We're a team. Like some of the guys here. Like Bob, come on up here, Bob. Bob King is the newest member to our team. Bob's only been involved with, come on up here on the stairs, Bob. He's only been involved in the VFW a few months. Actually, he'll tell you exactly how many months.
Tell us your name and your story, Bob. Tell us how you got in the VFW.
Bob King got in, became friends with Mike Wiley last year at this time at the Stern party. Asked Clay if I can get in, volunteered my time. Been about 5 months.
Yeah, that's not really how it went. So he... He comes. He's been coming to our show every year, and he's been asking everybody in the club, "How do I get involved with this? How do I get involved with this?" And we kept saying, "Okay, so we only take people that have skills. Are you a lawyer? No. Are you a doctor? No. Are you a plumber? No. Are you an electrician? No. Do you know how to fix pinball machines? No. Do you have any sort of experience related to anything? No. Nothing. He works at Comcast. You know, he's a warehouse monkey." So, you know, it's like I don't tend to take people like that because the training curve is just huge. It takes too much time and effort to bring people up to speed. But the one thing he had was gumption. He shows up. You know when they say that your mom, you saw us tell you, you know, you go apply for that job and it's 90% showing up, 10% knowledge, you know. Well, in a way that was true. So Bob still couldn't get in. So what did he do? He went to Wiley's wife, who's really good looking and has really huge fingernails, and he went to her and said, "How do I get in?" And then she came to me and said, I gotta have, you know, she put her arm around me and maybe rubbed up close to me and said, "I gotta have Bob King in the club." And I was, you know, who was I to say no? You know, so here he is, and he came in. And then, Bob, tell us about your experience when, you know, the first week of working there. You know, he had no idea what making the fucking donuts is all about.
Had no idea how much effort and time went into storing all the games. I just thought they did it themselves, or it was just much more simpler, but it's a lot of time and a lot of effort.
So basically, Bob thought that having 350, 400 games, they just fixed themselves, self-healing, you know. He's just a typical attendee to the show, just doesn't think about it, what goes into every game and what goes into the constant maintenance that in you know, Dave talked about that a little bit, you know, with his corral of games. And when you have more games, it ramps up. I mean, this is not a scalable thing. People say that. Like, I talked to Tim Arnold. Tim Arnold's got 200 games, Pinball Hall of Fame. He's like, "I want to make this bigger." And I keep looking at him going, "Why? You're pulling your hair out with 200 games. You think 400 is going to be easier? Really? I don't care if you got 1 million square feet. Who fucking cares? If you can't fix this shit, nobody's going to come or they're just going to be pissed off. This is not a scalable model. And anybody that tells you it's a scalable model is fucked in the head because they're wrong. You know, it's just as the more games you go, the harder the curve gets, the steeper it gets. It's a lot more work. And you can get to the point where you get so frustrated that you just want to shoot yourself. I mean, I work on this project every day. Every fucking day I am at the VFW. I live a quarter mile from the place. I can walk there. So even in snowstorms, I can go there and console with myself and drink beer, you know. But, you know, so people that think that this is an easy thing to do, it's not. You know, when you have a pinball show like this, you disseminate the work. You say, okay, who's bringing games? Well, I'm going to bring a game. Bob's going to bring a game. Pete's going to bring a game. Joe's going to bring a game. They're all responsible for their own game. Their own game breaks. They fix it. They buy the parts. They haul it in here. They set it up. They level it. They do whatever. Not so with the VFW. When we have a show, 99.999% of the games are our games. That means we're responsible for it. That means that we have to maintain them. We have to fix them. We have to buy the parts. We have to pay for everything that's involved with that. And that is an entirely different kettle of fish than a normal pinball show. Is it good? Yeah, it's good. All the games have a permanent home. You know what you're getting. It's a fixed commodity opposed to here. Who knows how many games were going to show up? Who knows what titles they were? You can go to our website, vfw.com, look on there and say, oh, gee, he's got a X, Y, and Z. I really want to play that. Well, that will be at the show, and it will be working. Okay, where here you don't really know. It's kind of like a guess. Now, there's good and bad to that. The consistency, you know, is good on a lot of levels, but on a lot it's less interesting because you already know what you're getting. You know, unless you never go to the website, then I guess you don't know. But I think most people can go on there and just click on games, and then you can see pictures of all the games, a little description of it. We show a general picture and a playfield picture, so you can see the general condition of the game, too. That's unlike any other show in the country. Nobody does that. So even the Pacific Pinball Museum doesn't have pictures of their games. And even in the stuff in their fixed museum, not their warehouse, but their fixed museum, they don't have pictures of the games. They don't even have a list of their games. So nobody does that kind of stuff. So we try and be a little different. Bob, I think, you know, he learned coming on that all this stuff doesn't happen by accident. It's all work. Okay? And I mean, yeah, do I do this a lot? Yes. Do other people help? Hell yeah. Every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're all there fixing stuff. Every Friday night, we get together and we play it all. And that is an important part of the equation. Because games sitting break. They just do. They need to be used. So, guys come in on Friday, they fill up their cup of beer, they play the games, and then I got a big whiteboard, and when they see something's wrong, they write it on there, or I actually encourage them to try and fix it themselves, which sometimes doesn't go well. It just depends on the person. Some people are better at that than others, obviously. So, that's the other reason why we want people in the organization that have some experience. Is so you can go back, Bob. I don't mean to leave you up here like some kind of trophy, you know. You know, so that's why, you know, so we've tried to create a system. Now, can we keep going? No, 400 games is probably where it's going to end, mostly because we keep adding new buildings and to house the additional games. And, you know, it's $50,000 every time I want to put a building up. And I got to go through the city to get permits. And I got to heat the thing. And I got to electrify it, which is ongoing costs every month. And all that stuff just adds up. And the only way we make money is the pinball show in the spring. In theory, that's supposed to pay for the whole year. Does it? Hell no. But it helps a lot. A real lot. And if anybody wants numbers, you know, you can see me. I don't really want to publicly say them, but I am more than happy to share numbers or what our revenue intakes are for the show. I have no problem telling people that. We pay taxes on everything. We are official. We are on board. We are, we are a commercial facility that has all the paperwork in order. So we don't try and skate, because believe me, I've skated the authorities in the past, and that never ends well. You can't fight City Hall. So, but anyways. I'm sorry, I got off on a tangent. Any other questions? So he asked where the secret marijuana patch is. There's a sign inside the VFW that says secret marijuana patch with an arrow pointing in one direction, and then secret police headquarters with arrow pointing in the other direction. And Ron wants to know where the patch is, and it's secret. That's why. It's secret. If it wasn't secret, we wouldn't tell you, or we would. No, we're not showing anybody. You know? So, any other questions? Yes, sir. Okay, so the question was, how do you get into the show? What's the cost? Again, our show runs a little differently. First off, we sell a limited number of tickets. That is different than any other show on the planet because most people are trying to maximize the number of people through the door because every head through is an additional $20, $30, $40, whatever they charge. So everybody's trying to maximize that. We don't do it that way. We have 400 games. For any given day, we'll sell 400 tickets. That way, there aren't lines. We don't do media interviews. I don't call the news and get any sort of publicity. We don't do any of that because every year we sell out every day of the show. It's a three-day show, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. When you come on Friday, it's just as good as when you come on Sunday. Like a lot of shows, the Sunday's the worst day because the games disappear. People sell them, they go home, you know, whatever. They got to get up and go to work on Monday. They don't want to deal with it, so they leave on Saturday night or what have you. Not at our show. We also have a full repair and restoration shop right on premises. We start with 400 working games. We end with 400 working games. And I am serious about that. Last year, we had 350 games. We did not have a single permanent breakdown. Now, did games break during the show? Hell yeah. It happens. But we were able to fix every one of them within a very short period of time. So, and we're really proud of that, and I'd like to thank Danny and Bruce. Those are our two lead technicians sitting right there. Bruce is like a million years old. Danny's his son. He's 23. He's probably one of the best pinball repair guys we've gotten. He's 20 fucking 3 years old. I mean, that kid doesn't even have nose hairs. Yes, sir. Yeah, everything's on free play. Right, right. Yeah, one price. And depending on the day, like Saturday costs a little more than Friday and Sunday, mostly because there's more hours on the Saturday. You know, Saturday's like an all-day thing. Friday is in afternoon, and Sunday, we're over by 5 o'clock because, you know, everybody wants to go home. And then we have a couple tournaments, too. We do tournaments. We do a Friday tournament, all on EMs. All our tournaments are always EM-based. We don't do any solid-state tournaments. We do everything just on electromechanical games because we find that people that don't have a ton of experience tend to do better on EM games for whatever reason, and that's, you know, arguable, but that's been our experience, you know. So you won't see Keith Elwin at our show. You won't see any of those guys at our show because, you know, there's no money involved. It's just coming to play. And you get a different slate of people. People that want to play pinball with a beer in one hand and a pizza in the other and shoot a little pinball and have fun with it and maybe win a trophy or some stupid gift card or a gag gift or whatever we're giving away. So we do things a little different, and the tournaments are always flat, $20. You know, there's no buy-ins, you know, like, you know, you got to keep throwing money into it, you know. We don't do any of it like that. We try and keep things real simple. So, yes, sir. Okay, so question is, what is the ratio of solid state to electromechanical? It is on our website. You can look. We actually have a hard percentage. I would guess it's probably 1/3 EM, 2/3 solid state. That would be my guess. But I haven't looked at the numbers lately. We have a shitload of EMs. We like EMs a lot. We have wood rails. We have all kinds of stuff post-war. I don't really have any pre-war stuff that's coming. Not this year. Not for 2018. But probably for 2019 we'll have more pre-war flipless stuff. But, you know, my experience with EMs and wood rails especially is that the fan base for them is a lot smaller, so you know you're appealing to a smaller crowd, and sometimes you want to appeal to the widest crowd you can. Not that we don't have a lot of EMs, we have tons, but I think that there's more enthusiasm for solid states right now, just in general. You know, like we've got a nearly complete Bally Dash 35-17 collection, nearly complete Sicaria Generation 2 collection, nearly complete 6803 collection, nearly complete Bally WPC collection, nearly complete Williams System 11 collection, nearly complete Williams 3 through 7 collection. We've got all the great wedge heads. We have 20 wood rails, I want to say, maybe 25. So we're really trying to have a nice wide array that appeals to a lot of people. Because everybody, you know, it's like ice cream. Everybody's got a particular flavor, but there are vanillas and chocolates that apply generically to a lot of people. So, you know, we try and run the gamut like that. Another question? Yes, sir. Went to the show. He loved it. Yay! Thank you. Okay, so question is whose idea and why did we make our bathroom so fancy? So both our men's and ladies' rooms have bidets in them. So why did we put bidets in there? Do you guys all know what a bidet is? I mean, I know you know, but to the rest of the people, you guys, I'm sure, look it up, internet. So why did we do that? Well, because we're on a septic field, and toilet paper is the evil goddess of septic fields. So to minimize the usage of that, we installed bidets, hoping that people would just use less toilet paper. And I think it's worked out well, and it's a feature that you're not going to see at any other pinball show. A lot of ladies really like it. I get a lot of comments from the ladies, a lot of comments that they love that. And actually I've gotten other comments and emails thanking me and that they've gone and purchased one for their home. So, you know, we get a cut of the bidet business. No, I'm just kidding. So, any other questions? Yes, sir. Mitigate that. Okay, so question is, who do we use for parts? I buy most everything from Pinball Resource when I can, but we buy a lot from Pinball Life, too. Now, Pinball Resource, God bless the guy. He's awesome, but he gives no discounts. I mean, he gives the same discount to everybody, I should say. $100, 10% off. But there's no scale there. Pinball Life, there's scale. Terry gives us a wholesale price on anything I buy. So I'm really appreciative of Terry doing that. I would like to buy more stuff from Marco, but in reality, Marco buys a lot of his stuff from Pinball Life because Terry's a manufacturer of parts, and he buys a lot from PBR, too. So, you know, unless it's something weird, I can usually get it less expensive from either PBR or from Pinball Life than I can from Marco. I like Marco a lot. He's a great guy. He's really, really helpful, and sometimes he has stuff that nobody else has. And he's got the best parts website by far on the planet. I mean, you can go on there, and he's got pictures and good descriptions and part numbers and all that kind of stuff. And I wish I could buy more from him. Just he's pricey, and probably for good reason. He's, you know, that website, I'm sure, wasn't free. So, you know, it all costs money. Any other questions? Yes, sir, David. Excuse me, are we going to do much more with Pinball Ninja? You know, Pinball Ninja's kind of on a little vacation right now, mostly because I just haven't had time to do everything. There's only so much time in the day. I mean, literally, I'm up at 5:15 every day and go to bed at 11. And that every minute of that is directly related to pinball. I also have to earn a living so I can pay for all this crap, and that gets in the way, too. So, yeah, more will be coming, but it's just all about time. It's the same thing with the repair guides. I just added the new Zakaria repair guide to the website, and it's not finished, and I would like to do more with it, but it's just all about time. And I would like to redo the, you know, the Bally's and the System 11s and the Data East and the WPC, so on and so forth. But it's just, you know, it's on the agenda to get done, but it just hasn't happened yet. So any other questions? All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it.